Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
Welcome back, folks. We set aside time every Tuesday in the 11 o'clock hour for our NOLA Coalition segment, and we have been the beneficiary of meeting with folks that are really difference makers throughout the city, in our community. A lot of the work that they do goes unnoticed. There's not much talk about it, but these are folks that really give a damn, and they're working hard each and every day. And today's no different. We're joined by Melania Talia, President and CEO of the New Orleans Police and Justice Foundation. Melania, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Newell. Thank you for having us.
It's a pleasure to have you. Obviously, you guys have provided a lot of support and sustenance in so many different programs over the years for the NOPD and others within the first responder community. Obviously, the January 1st terrorist attack on Bourbon Street, horrific, obviously. And I know that y'all have been providing some services in the aftermath of that. I'd love for you to, one, comment on the event, and then some of what you guys have been providing.
Certainly. Well, Newell, I'm sure like everyone else across the city of New Orleans, I was absolutely horrified as these events unfolded. And the people who made the ultimate sacrifice that day, they remain and continue in our thoughts and in our prayers, as well as all of the heroes that were out there that day. Of course, our focus is the New Orleans Police Department. I was out in the French Quarter on January 2nd and again on January 3rd, just checking in with folks to see how they're doing, what it is that they need. Needless to say, there are some need more than others, and we're here to provide those, take care of those things, whatever they happen to be. And officer health and wellness is part of where we have our focus. So we are, and that continues, the effort to make the city as safe as we can possibly make it, through training and equipment supplies, that continues. And, of course, we now are looking at a global consultant in security who may be able to bring additional security to the city of New Orleans.
First, let's talk about officer health and wellness. And I don't mean in at a granular level, just overall. What are you seeing? What are you hearing from officers?
No, they're humble, I think is the best word I can tell you. They're tired. It's been a long couple of weeks, as it has been for many people across the city of New Orleans. But you talk to them and they say, this is my job. They get up tomorrow, they lace up their boots, they don their gun and their badge, and they go to work. And whether they're guiding tours through the French Quarter, and we do have some folks who are in town and enjoying the culture of New Orleans. So whether they're assisting tourists with restaurants and directions, or they're handling homicides and other egregious offenses that we have seen starting off this new year, they're working. They are working. They have a job to do, and they are going to do it. And that's one of the many reasons why we have so many heroes at the New Orleans Police Department. Not every hero wears a cape. A lot of heroes wear a badge.
Absolutely. Melania, you know, we have a lot of visitors that have come to the city. Any reporting are you hearing from officers about their response to the officers? Because, you know, my experience has always been when folks come in the aftermath of an event like this is they really do a great job of showing their appreciation for law enforcement. I'm just wondering if you're hearing any anecdotal stories on that front.
Well, I can tell you from personal experience, having been downtown just this past weekend and speaking not only with officers, but with tourists. And myself, I said, well, thank you for coming. And a few people said, you know, we thought twice about it, but we love New Orleans, or we've never been here before. And New Orleans is such a wonderful city. We wanted to come and we wanted to show our support for the people of New Orleans and for the city and for the culture. And the officers have expressed the same, that as they're walking their beat and the mounted officers on horseback and canine making their sweeps, that everyone is truly, truly grateful for their heroic acts and for their sacrifice.
Yeah, I was just kind of curious how that would be. You know, we have some big conventions, as you well know, headed our way before we get to the Super Bowl. So no rest for the weary. It's kind of week after week after week, and then we're right into Mardi Gras, right?
Week after week, Super Bowl and then Mardi Gras, of course, right? Parades have already kicked off. They might not be the traditional parade that's coming down St. Charles Avenue, but parades have already kicked off. There's a Super Bowl parade that's scheduled. So as you say, Noel, there is no rest for the weary, but we're going to get it done.
Melania, you mentioned the contracting of a nationally known security consultant whose, you know, reputation is second to none, and everybody is in law enforcement circles is familiar with Bill Bratton. The thought process for you guys, and you know, a lot of people, I think, misinterpreted what I was saying the other day about I thought that the city should step up and pay for it, although I'm not heavy into symbolism, but I think, you know, this mentality of the private sector having to step up a lot, although it may go faster by doing so, the city needs to own it. And I'll continue to say that, but I it doesn't mean that I'm not appreciative of what y'all have done historically and what y'all continue to do. The thought process behind this.
Well, Bill, in times such as this, it's not uncommon for the Police and Justice Foundation to be the first organization that gets a phone call and gets that ask for help. We are founded on the concept of being a public-private partnership. And, of course, 30 years ago when we were founded, one of our first efforts was to bring in Jack Maple and to create the Pennington Plan, after which the city saw a huge reduction in crime, actually led the nation in crime reduction, not so unlike what we see today. And, yes, Bill Bratton, everyone in law enforcement circles is familiar with Bill. He is the executive chairman of the risk advisory team at Teneo, a global advisory firm. So we are happy to assist wherever we can, particularly with the speed at which we can work. We're always standing ready, willing, and able to assist the city of New Orleans and the New Orleans Police Department in whatever way we can. And at this point in time, it's still a very fluid situation, so certainly more to come. And happy to share that with you once it's all firmed up.
So is he or is he not under contract at the present time?
Still a fluid situation. There's still some things that are being worked out. And as soon as that is all firmed up, we'll let you know.
The public's expectation is, and I don't know why it is, because I haven't seen anybody saying this, but maybe I may be wrong. Is there an anticipation that a report will be issued in advance of the Super Bowl or in advance of Mardi Gras?
Right now, as I understand it from Teneo, they will be conducting some assessments and they will, of course, be making recommendations immediately. And I think a lot of what we'll see will be recommendations made in real time. The Super Bowl is less than 1 month away. Mardi Gras shortly thereafter. So I think, I think it's just going to be a very fluid situation as the days come and as they learn and they conduct their assessments and they gather data, they will be issuing recommendations right there on the spot.
And you have a lot of experience with this because you've been involved in a lot of these engagements. I have to imagine that these would be the type of recommendations that these experts believe that we could execute on prior to those events, right?
Yes, absolutely. They will anticipate and they will make recommendations on how we might mitigate risks. Focusing on the January 1 event, they do have a team of intelligence experts. I'm certain that they will join us. And with our SEER 1 rating, the special event assessment rating that we've now gotten from the federal government, that will bring in additional resources and federal interagency support. So I would hope that and believe that we can and will implement recommendations accordingly.
Have you guys had any preliminary conversations with security, maybe not Bratton and his group, but other security experts about this, this SEER 1 rating? I'm hearing a lot of talking heads talking in generalities about the breadth and depth of federal support that'll be brought here. Mardi Gras is kind of a different animal than an event site. Typically is what is designated as a SEER 1 rating. Your thoughts about that?
We've had extensive conversations with the NOPD leadership as well as city leadership, and there was an extensive briefing with Mr. Bratton and Teneo experts. They do understand that Mardi Gras is, for instance, it's not the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. Mardi Gras is a very different event. It spans from one end of the city to the other, and it is attended by millions of people, whether they're residents or visitors. So they do understand that there is a difference. They are learning more about that every moment as time passes, and they will be prepared for that.
I have been to 3 Macy's parades, and I can tell you from personally experience, they're not even in the same stratosphere as it relates to the challenges of those parades. I mean, not even close. It's kind of interesting. Let's pivot for a moment, if you don't mind, Melania, and let's talk about a quick recap of 2024 crime stats. I had an opportunity to visit with Rafi Garnacci this past Thursday on the show. A lot of what was reported out was very impressive. But more importantly, clearance rates being 2 and 3 times the average of the NOPD in recent history just cannot go unnoticed.
Newell, I agree. Our crew in blue at the New Orleans Police Department has just done an amazing job. I myself took a look at Rafi's end-of-year report. The crime trends are just incredibly impressive. Going back to the police foundation often being the first one to get a call, the police foundation initiated a consultant in 2022, and by the end of his engagement in 2023, we had started to experience some of those reductions in crime. That engagement ended and Chief Kirkpatrick was appointed. And when she added her strategies to what was the momentum that we had, crime continued to decrease. And of course, most recently, Governor Landry and the creation of Troop NOLA. So I think we now have federal, state, and local agencies working together, perhaps in a way that we have not seen in quite some time. And as New Orleanians, we are benefiting tremendously from that partnership and from that coordination.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and my hat's off to him. And it was nice to finish really in a strong, positive way. And I think you would support what I'm saying here is that when you look at these trends, it's really nice when you see multi-year trends of reductions, and they've embarked upon at least 18 to 20 months of trends thus far. So I don't know about you, but I feel good about the direction where they're going. And if they had 100 more officers or 150 more or whatever the complement is that they're below, it would be a game changer for them.
I agree wholeheartedly. I believe that New Orleans and the New Orleans Police Department, we have achieved a new normal, and we, the citizens, have come to expect and, of course, deserve. And the women and men at the New Orleans Police Department are working as hard as they can to deliver in partnership with the federal and state partners. But now we have it. Now we have a new normal, and we have to continue to evaluate every day where resources are being deployed, what resources are available, and how are we going to not only maintain, but hopefully improve. I think we can all agree that there'll never be zero crime. I wish that we could live in that world. I don't think that's going to happen. No. But if we can maintain, if we can improve, that would be tremendous.
Melania, y'all have always been involved in an integral way with recruitment. This has been a problem across the country, actually around the world, quite frankly. I was reading some articles the other day about European police forces and recruitment issues, very similar to what we're experiencing in the United States. What are your thoughts about where we stand today and looking forward into 2025?
Well, we the Police Foundation were intimately involved in the generation of applications process and in taking the NOPD recruitment office from a paper-driven process to one that is more state-of-the-art technological. And in 2023, it was time to take off the training wheels. So we turned over what we had developed to the police department, and they have been solely responsible for it since the summer of 2023. I think moving forward, we will see some changes at that department. They're really doing a deep dive into some data collection and the performance of the last 10 years or so and making some adjustments. The world we live in today is a little bit more than the old-fashioned let's go to a job fair. It's all about technology. It's all about social media. It's all about online. And Newell, because it is a problem nationally, it's all about who gets to you first. So when those candidates apply, NOPD's got to be right there to jump on it right away and say, we want you. Let's get you through this process, and let's get you into the police academy. And I know that recruiting is a focus for Superintendent Kirkpatrick. So I expect we will see some improvement there.
Absolutely. Best of luck to you guys in 2025. Thank you and your organization for all that you've done, not only historically, but what you continue to do in making the city of New Orleans a safe place to live, work, and raise our family. It sounds cliche, but that's what everybody desires. And a lot of the success that they've had is in large measure because of a lot of the contributions that your organization has made, and I for one know that and appreciate it, and a lot of others do as well. So keep up the great work.
Thank you, Newell. Thank you for everything that you do for getting information out to the public. It's critically important.
Thank you, ma'am. Melania Talia, the president and CEO of New Orleans Police and Justice Foundation. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. What a difference an election makes. Meta makes a lot of different moves to advance free expression. And David and Sarah, fellow for free expression and technology at the Cato Institute, published a commentary the other day, and it's pretty spot on. And he joins us. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, David, I don't know about you. I was blown away. I was shocked when this news broke of what Mark Zuckerberg had proposed and laying out six ways that Meta would be changing to better favor free expression. Your thoughts, and if you could take us through these six things that they intend to do.
Yeah, so I think these are all, many of these are changes that we should be embracing. These are changes that are, just off the top, are replacing fact checkers with a community notes type program, simplifying and reducing content moderation, especially around contentious topics, reducing sort of the errors that can occur by making some changes in the way they moderate content, and letting people access more political and civic content. And they're also moving content moderation teams around and pushing back against foreign censorship. Those are the changes that Mark laid out and Meta has laid out. And I think many of those should be applauded because free expression, improving ideas like these, are the way that we as a society make progress. It's the way that we deliberate things. It's the way we improve. And so we should be looking at these and saying, how can we get even more expression? Are there things that we can do more of and see more of from companies in the way that they create products for users?
I don't know about you, but did you ask yourself the question, why now?
Yeah, I certainly did. And I have to think that there's some element of this. In fact, there's been a lot of people criticizing Meta for saying, well, this is just because they're bowing to politics. I think that is certainly maybe part of what's going on. The new administration is coming in, and free expression has been a significant argument that people something that, honestly, I worked at Meta. I joined the day back in 2019 when Mark Zuckerberg gave a speech at Georgetown talking about the importance of free expression. I think this is part of one of his beliefs, but over the past few years, it just got whittled away, whether it be the pandemic or other things that were happening. Everyone was just arguing we need to take more and more content down. But now, I think with this new administration coming in, there's an opportunity for him to embrace, I think, that part of him that always believed that he was creating products that were about giving people a voice, like giving people expression. And so it's time to return to that.
Were you surprised with his complete and, it seemed to me, very transparent disclosure of his interaction with the Biden administration? As I watched him talk about it, it was almost as though there was like this sense of disgust that he had kind of compromised his core beliefs, and they went down a path that in hindsight he looks at and believes that these were dark days for what was then called Facebook, now Meta.
Yeah, exactly. I saw him, lay out on his own little announcement, but then also a longer form discussion on Joe Rogan, where he goes through this, and you can tell that he's frustrated with the ways in which the U.S. government has treated Meta, whether it be especially around the COVID issues, but even beyond those, the ways in which the Biden administration was pressuring social media companies to take down certain forms of content. And there was a Supreme Court case about this. While that case, I don't think, turned out the way that some people had hoped, the core idea, that the court still recognized that some of the problems of what was going on, and these admissions by Zuckerberg, sort of very, as you pointed out, very sort of, I think, genuinely being upset at what was going on, points out that this is a problem that doesn't just have implications for what's going on in the U.S., but also has an implication for how foreign governments act. If the U.S. government isn't going to protect or help Meta when foreign governments are trying to censor or regulate big American tech companies, if the American government isn't going to help, then what can these companies do? And that just leads to even more censorship that affects American consumers and American businesses.
Do you think that there was, in his thinking, and I mean, this is asking for conjecture, I guess, but, you know, he for the most part, kind of travels in more of the liberal circles, so to speak. And, you know, there was a time where the pressure on him was really even greater than government pressure. I mean, there was just a lot of party political pressure on Facebook to engage in this content moderation, you know, for the sake of whatever the political ideology of that day was.
Yeah, no, I can actually say this as just part of even my own experience. I was on the Meta's content policy team who wrote this community standard. So I can say very clearly that I felt that pressure from largely sort of progressive anti-expression interest groups. There's a lot of people who were lobbying Meta to take down more and more content. And Mark talks about this. He says that, look, we're constantly being asked to take more and more down. And at the beginning, you're taking down like the obviously bad stuff that no one wants to see, terrorism and child sexual exploitation. But then every step that you move beyond that obviously bad stuff, you're increasingly moving into the space of, well, yes, that's an increasingly important political speech. That's increasingly important social discussion. And while someone views it as hate speech, someone views it as misinformation, every additional policy that was added was increasingly removing the ability for users to speak on these important issues. And that pressure, yeah, it wasn't just the government. It did extend to, I think, a broader push within a lot of parts of our society that says, you know, expression is dangerous, especially certain kinds of expression that hurt certain types of people in certain ways. And that's what led to, I think, this sort of backlash that we've seen. And now we're seeing Meta and also X, responding to that backlash and making significant changes. Or next case, Elon Musk is buying them outright.
Yeah. This is going to sound like a crazy question, but I'm just kind of curious, in your roundtable discussions when you were there, Did anybody ever ask the question, what is truth?
Yeah, so when it comes to the question of misinformation, this is a really great question, because how you ascertain what truth is a huge whole area of academic and scientific study. But yeah, so the question is, do we rely on truth as the taking the form of whatever certain select fact checkers say? And that is sort of the approach that was taken by Meta. The truth, what is true and what is false, what is misleading, determined by fact checkers that, you know, sort of self-appointed themselves. But the reality is that usually when we want to know what is true, what is false, it's usually because we're having a debate about something. When a scientist says, I found a cure for cancer, we don't say, yeah, you're an expert, we believe you. No, there's testing involved. Other scientists criticize the study. They find faults with it. They literally test the hypothesis. The same thing is true when we're in societies having our conversations about any number of issues. We develop truth through this sort of rolling critical consensus. We're constantly debating these ideas. And only when we can all agree to some sort of consensus, we say, yes, we can all sort of see that this is proven true. So much of what's been taken down, what is being fact-checked, is something where it can't be objectively studied. It's subjective decisions about, did you include the right context? Did you frame this the wrong way? That's what journalism is. Journalism is just context and framing and bringing facts to users in certain ways. But those aren't objective decisions that were being made by these fact checkers, but they were being given the imprimatur of fact. That's what Meta was saying. These are true, these are false, this is objective, and it's just not what was going on.
You just engaged in a great explanation about this, and many times I find, you know, in the radio business you have this experience as well, where a lot of times a listening audience does not actually engage in asking of themselves critical questions and trying to seek out that answer, right? And it leads to a lot of confusion, you know, about what is opinion, what is fact, you know, and what is subjective, what is objective. A lot of times in a lot of sectors of our communities across this country and around the world have no understanding of what any of that is, right?
Yeah, so this whole process of, like I said, of determining what is true, what is false, this is an area where, like I said, you pick up a lot of time. There are whole areas of academic study dedicated to this. And I think it's important that basically we keep in mind, and your users keep, your listeners keep in mind, that how we develop knowledge is a process that every single person engages in. You talking to your neighbor and you say, is that really true? What's your facts? What's your sources? Or, I've heard this somewhere. Do you think that's true? And you say, I think that's kind of true, but maybe.
All right, we're going to get to a break. We're going to try and get David and Sarah back on again. So stay with us. We will be right back. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with David and Sarah, Fellow for Free Expression and Technology at the Cato Institute. And David previously revealed that he actually worked for Meta at some point in time in his life. And we were talking about folks understanding the subjective and objective nature of things said, opinion versus fact. And I think that's where we lost you, David.
Yeah, sorry about that.
So if you could just kind of, you know, and I said, you know, sometimes the listening audience has really difficulty separating the two. And I think that adds a lot to this angst and anxiety that we see relative to what's being posted out there and trying to decide, you know, what is truth?
Yeah. As I was saying, a lot of what we discuss in the media, what you see in your reporting, some of it is objective facts being reported. But a lot of time we're talking about subjective opinions, biases, the way things are framed, the way things, the facts that you choose in your articles. These are all things that are subjective. And it's part of what it means to have a discussion, right? The New York Times posts its version of a story. The Wall Street Journal posts its version. We don't just run around and say everyone's engaging in misinformation. What we're doing is we're engaging in a conversation about how we can whittle down, okay, what is true here? What is the objective truth? Is there something we can even assess as objective? Sometimes it's, we just don't know. it's an opinion. We can't determine it. And that's where debate comes in, and having that understanding of, you know, maybe I don't have all the objective truth at my fingertips.
I, like you, as you point out in your article, was a little disappointed with a couple of sections of what Mark Zuckerberg was talking about. And specifically, the one that really irritated me was number 5, where he says moving content moderation teams to Texas and elsewhere. I'm not one that's, you know, gets engaged in doing things for symbolic purposes. But this thing, I thought, that whole conversation really rang hollow.
Yeah, that's one where I have friends, I have former colleagues who they work in different parts of California or out in the western part of the country, and now they're going to move to D.C. or to Texas. I mean, it's like, okay, there's some people who their lives are going to be upended, and all because you want fewer of those people in California and more of them in Texas, where, by the way, Meta already had a big office, and in D.C., where Meta already has a big office. So it's like, it's a change that, I don't think will inspire a whole, new amount of greater expression. What you need is, I think, a more deep commitment to ideological diversity. You need institutions within your organization that are dedicated to free expression. Like, there are changes you can make that are institutional and structural in nature to value free expression. But just announcing you're moving a few people to Texas, I'm skeptical on that one.
While you were there, did you feel like there was space for conservative thought?
You know, it's certainly an area where I think even Mark testified in the past to this. Like, it's a difficult space for, you know, people who were more conservative to express themselves. It's the entire trust and safety, the sort of content policy, content moderation, tech space is one that is dominated by people who tend to be more left of center. And now that's fine. And on many, many, many issues, me and my colleagues, we had different ways of looking at it. We disagreed on, you know, very civil ways. But there's also a sense in the companies that in a lot of the tech companies that there's a lot of pressure to just, as we talked about earlier, a lot of pressure from outside groups. And that also bleeds on into the inside. There are people in different parts of the company who they do believe that, look, this expression is dangerous. We need to remove this content. And sometimes, you know, I was sitting there being like, well, that's what I believe. That's what people I know believe. Like, I'm trying not to make it too personal, but that is like, you know, people are saying that things that are maybe close to me or close to people I know are hate speech or are clearly false misinformation. That hurts. And that is something that's hard to explain to some people in a community where, in a company where there are too many people who just think the same way about free expression. And that's why, like I said, I think you need more changes within Meta to say, we actually are going to do more to value free expression so that those different perspectives are heard more commonly. This can't just be like a once and done kind of thing by Meta, but I do think that there are additional changes that they could make if they wanted to embrace free expression more fulsomely.
You know, I was the former leader of a law enforcement organization. At our all-time high, we had over 1,700 employees. And as I read through this, I mean, I agree with you. I think it's something that we ought to embrace. I think it's positive. But I also believe that there are going to be huge, significant challenges to changing the culture of an organization overnight. It's not going to happen.
Yep. Yeah, and that's exactly right. And when I was at Meta, me and a couple of my other, you know, colleagues had thought through what some of those things might look like. And I think these are the kind of things that I think any company could look at and be like, okay, if we want to care about free expression more, you have to make changes that make it, it has to be structural, it has to be institutional. So things like, well, why don't we have part of our teams which are just dedicated to free expression? Like, there's so many teams within the content moderation space that are dedicated to taking content down. And I get it. It's their job. They're dedicated to keeping people safe or to thinking about, you know, they're part of the legal team and they're very, you know, risk averse people. Like, that's their job, is to make sure that, you know, legal risks or potential safety risks, those things are taken down. But where's the team that's saying, I want more expression for our users, to always be advocating for users, to be doing more and more research that always is finding the benefits of free expression. I think we need, you know, there are teams that could be set up that value free expression more and to be an advocate for users in that way. I also think there are other changes you can make to say, hey, you know what? Part of your annual review process is not just to say, how well did you do this year on these various other metrics, but how well did you advance users' expression? We are a platform dedicated to giving people a voice. How did you do that this year? There are different ways you can try to change a culture slowly but surely that with these sort of institutional changes. But it does start at the top, and at least Mark is talking about that now, and I think very blunt and very, very clear ways.
Yeah. Great article on your part. Really enjoyed reading and some of it. I didn't really realize that you had actually worked for Meta. So you have an insight that most people don't have, specifically as it relates to content moderation, which was really interesting to hear you talk about. And it'll be interesting to see how fast this gets embraced within the organization. I think there's going to be some pushback and some friction. You would know better than most, and I just don't see it happening quick. But we're definitely headed for different times, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is something that, at least in the immediate future, this is going to happen. And even so, even after that announcement, there were more changes. Meta said it was stopping its DEI programs. It was, you know, he then went on Joe Rogan. Like, it's clear that Mark, and I should also mention that he also made changes in his leadership. The president of the policy shop is now someone else. So there are significant changes happening. And so I said, the question is can we make these go beyond just the immediate? Can we make these, does Meta want to make these more resilient against future change? Because I think that's what Meta should want here, is that it's not just about even the politics of this moment, but what about in 4 years or 8 years, whatever it is. We should want our value of free expression to not be sort of dependent on which political party wins an election. I would hope that our value for expression would be more long lasting, more resilient. And to do so, like I said, creating those institutional changes is so important to go beyond just, like I said, this political moment, this cultural moment, as Mark talks about. So like I said, I'm hopeful about that.
And I don't know if this is the right word, but the word balance just keeps coming to mind, right? And we hear that in mainstream media all the time, you know, people, the criticism, there seems to be like no balance.
Yeah. So the idea that a lot of the criticism that is happening is that, you know, like, oh, yeah, where he's the Meta is kowtowing to Trump, that they're not balancing, you know, their different interests very well. I have to say that I think that for the past few years, the balance has been way off. And this is what Mark himself is saying. There was such a focus on taking content down, on removing all the various risks, that I would argue they were already significantly out of balance. And so I think if anything, this is more of a return to balance. Now, people will disagree on that, but that's why, like I said, my what I would hope is that it's not about just this moment, but that we seek a broader, within the company, Meta seeks a broader emphasis on free expression. But even as a society, we remember the importance of free expression so that it's not just about the politics of this moment.
You know what gets me is that whenever there was a mistake made, and I think you would agree with this, more often than not, it diminished conservative thought, you know, and in the after action, it always seemed to go that way. Got to get to a break. David and Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. Fellow for Free Expression and Technology at the Cato Institute. Have a great week.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. When we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. Stay with us. We'll be right back.